Personal conversations, public outcry, public engagement led to change for women in the workplace. It happened not because our leaders stepped up and said, oh, we must do something about sexual harassment. It happened because we raised our voices.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. Tonight we'll be discussing reimagining equality with Anita Hill, professor of social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University. I'm Tricia Rose, Brown University professor, and I will be your moderator. In her new and amazing memoir, Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home, Anita Hill takes the idea of home and explores how our family homes and our national home are linked to understandings of achievement, opportunity, and equality. Hill takes us on a journey that begins with her own family story and ends with the current mortgage meltdown. Along the way, we visit homes across America and meet some extraordinary African-American women, from playwright Lorraine Hansberry to Baltimore hairdresser Anjanette Booker. The youngest of 13 children, Anita Hill grew up on a farm in rural Oklahoma. After receiving her JD from Yale University in 1980, she worked in private practice and for the federal government in Washington, D.C. Hill is the author of numerous professional articles on international commerce, commercial law, bankruptcy, and civil rights. Her book, Speaking Truth to Power, detailed her experience as a witness in Clarence Thomas's Supreme Court confirmation hearings. Her latest book, Reimagining Equality, is the basis for our present discussion. It's a marvelous book, and the first thing I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk specifically about is how and why you settled on the very interesting hybrid format that you settled on. There's personal storytelling, there's individual storytelling about African American women throughout the 20th century, but there's also in-depth historical, social, contextual policy analysis, and the connections are made between them. I mean, it's a very rich format. It's clearly quite intense. Can you speak a little bit to what you had in mind?
Well, I wanted to, in writing the book, I wanted to start with how people really learn and think, how they learn about inequalities. You know, we learn about inequalities or we learn inequality through a number of devices. We learn through history. We learn through laws. How we think about equality is sometimes shaped by how we feel about the law, how we think about rights. But we also learn about equality through pop culture and literature. Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun really was a story about what are the in-game results of an integrated society, of a quest for equality, a dream. We learn about it through pop culture, like the Jeffersons. We learn about inequalities through pop culture that depict women in unfavorable ways. And so I wanted to really reach the reader where and how they learn about these topics. But I also wanted to offer more than simply storytelling. For me, it's important for us to link this behavior in our own understanding to the policies and laws that are in place. And so that's why I wanted to come to the readers with a different way of thinking about all of those devices that they have heard throughout their lives.
Oh, it works really very well. On page 112, yes, I'm an academic. We take page
notes.
Look at
page 112.
You don't. I'll quote you.
Okay.
I'll quote you right now. It's okay. You say the persistent devaluation of those things black and those things female undermines our communities and our country, culturally and economically. And I was struck throughout the book by this desire to make real and personal and emotionally connecting the stories of individual Black women of a variety of class positions. And I wanted, if you could, speak to how you think we can move from, as you said, tolerance to real belonging across race and gender. Because it strikes me that this notion of home is about how we can share this space in more meaningful, connected ways.
Well, the word empathy, we've heard it. We've heard it bandied about politically, particularly when it comes to the Supreme Court nominations. But it really is, in some ways, it's about empathy. But it's really about more. It's about not only understanding how these individuals feel, but also how what they feel and what happens to them relates to us. When we say, okay, look, African-American communities in Baltimore are devastated, and we try to isolate that, you know, we're not only not, you know, we feel bad for people, we're showing empathy, but that's not enough. What we have to understand is that the devastation of those communities hurts all of us. I talk about in one of the stories, the story of Marla, about the crime in her neighborhood, street crime that ultimately resulted in her son's death. And we like to think, okay, well, if we just stay out of those neighborhoods, then we will be fine. But in fact, we are not fine. We pay for those crimes ourselves. So in addition to empathy that I want you to get from these stories, I also want you to understand our connectedness and that the fates of individuals that we don't know and, you know, may not even read about in the newspaper really matter in our lives. The state entire, there's a reason that the state of Illinois is suing Wells Fargo, because, and that is simply put, because the Attorney General of Illinois knew that this was not an isolated neighborhood problem, that these were issues that impacted the entire country. The subprime lending debacle may have started in certain communities, but I dare any of you to find, to say that you don't know someone personally who has been affected by it, that you don't have a neighbor or a friend or a son or a daughter who will feel the impact of this crisis that really was just started out as African Americans, women, Latinos were targeted for toxic loans. And so that's really what I want us to do. I want us to feel empathy, but I also want us to understand how we're all connected in these issues. And as you know, because of the crisis, an entire financial, global financial system was brought to its knees. So we can't simply look at these things as isolated, unrelated matters. They matter to all of us.
So I'm going to ask one more question now and then invite questions from the audience. But I wanted to return to this question about Obama as a leader on these issues as well as a symbolic leader on these issues. But in particular, I'm struck by, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. It would be fabulous if he were to take up your vision and perhaps quote your own book at some point. That would be nice.
That would be nice.
That would be nice. But I guess I want to sort of be hopeful, but with some caution, which is to say that I'm struck by how little addressing the reality of structural inequality, when it speaks to class, when it speaks to race, when it speaks to gender, how little can be said about that in the public sphere. And that the moment you say it, it's as if the conversation comes to a grinding halt. There's enormous anxiety. Now, certainly, you know, the right wing is an easy scapegoat there, but I'd make the argument that there's a liberal middle that's highly uncomfortable with that kind of language. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, how could Obama, even if he had the goal, which we don't know, but assuming he had the goal to take this up, this kind of vision of home and belonging, to move from tolerance to buy-in, to move from empathy to structural change, you know, how possible is that in this climate? And in what ways can you imagine us creating a climate that would, in a sense, house your vision more fully?
Professor Rose makes a very compelling case, doesn't you? And were I not an optimist, I might just pack up and go home. But I am really a person who believes in change. And if you look at what has happened, if I think about what's happened in my family life in the last 100 years, if I think about what has happened in my lifetime as the beneficiary of Brown versus Board of Education, as a beneficiary of so many laws and efforts to achieve gender equality, I have to be optimistic. Now, I understand that it is difficult for President Obama to raise this issue. But this is really, to me, a question about whether or not we can continue to believe in the American dream. That's what this is about. That's what this book is about. Or whether we are going to continue to price people out of the American dream by putting it on the market and saying that the only way that you can achieve it is to buy a bigger house than your parents had, and certainly than your grandparents had. Mm. If that link between the American dream and the bigger home is one that I hope to disrupt. What I would see as the American dream really is the ability for everyone, regardless of where one lives, to have access to all of the opportunities that this country has to offer. That, for me, is the American dream. And it should not be determined by where we live. We don't give enough thought and have enough conversation about how where one lives determines where one goes to school, and in many cases, the quality of that education, how one is represented in Congress, and more basically, whether one is going to have access to basic needs like food, transportation, to a job that will pay a living wage. And so those are the things that I think we need to begin to talk about. I hope President Obama can lead that talk, and in Reimagining Equality, I tell him how I think it can be done. But if he can't, if the political times are too tight and too tough for him to lead that, then we have to lead that conversation. And we can do it. And if I would just get personal a little bit, I said I wasn't necessarily going to go back there, but I believe that in 1991, personal conversations, public outcry, public engagement led to change for women in the workplace. It happened not because our leaders stepped up and said, oh, we must do something about sexual harassment. It happened because we raised our voices. And we raised them in quiet ways in some respects. We raised them by talking in our homes, with our mothers, with our daughters, in some instances for the first time, with our spouses, about what our lives and experiences were like. And that's why I'm a believer. Because I understand the power of public engagement and discourse. Mm. And that's why I think this conversation can happen. I believe that if we do it, our very wise president will follow.
You're listening to Anita Hill discussing her new book, Reimagining Equality: Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home. Now let's take some questions from the audience.
Professor Hill, I'm from Michigan, and in the city of Detroit, there's great poverty and great privilege. Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, great privilege. Public schools that have vast resources in that same geographic area, great mm-hmm. poverty. So the question is, with people that would like to see change, how do you make that structural change? Because property values are tied in with educational quality. So even if people say, let's redistribute money at a statewide level, which would be more fair than just distributing it at a local level. Mm-hmm. How do you do that when people won't want their house values to decrease? So I'm just wondering if you can say a little bit about that, because I think there's a lot of people that would like to see change, but then their own interests somehow are affected and they hesitate.
Well, I think people have to understand that all interests are already being impacted. When we don't raise an educated population throughout, that we are all going to be suffering. And so, again, it's that connection that people have to make with the lives of others who may not have the privileges that they have. But I think we've got to retrain our thought. And many of those people in those very nice communities are suffering now. And so we have to ask them, are they willing to go back to put more money into a system that has put them at risk? And so with that, what I do ask for in the Home Summit is that I don't look at just how do we regulate banks. I look at how do we establish transportation systems? How do we make decisions about how roads are going to be paved? How do we make decisions about where jobs are going to be located? And so I'm really trying to look at this conversation as a holistic conversation so that we can really start to disrupt really our thinking, that kind of thinking about, well, this doesn't matter to me, and really make some structural and long-lasting changes.
Thank you.
My question is, or an observation I was making is, I'm a homeowner. I went to apply for a loan. I had a subprime mortgage first, 8.9%. I went to apply for a competing mortgage, and the officer who wanted to help me said, if you want to get this loan, you need to check off this box. And it was ethnicity. And the box he pointed at was Caucasian. And he didn't say that. He just said, if you want to get this loan, you need to check off this box. And I had too much pride to check off that box. I checked off African American, and of course I didn't get the loan. So, I mean, I mm-hmm. totally related to what you were saying. And I was able to refinance later on and get a much better rate. And I want to ask you something. What do you have to say to people who point to the individual successes, such as Obama or yourself, and say that racism no longer exists and we have arrived?
I would really direct them to this is chapter 7 of my book, Reimagining Equality, and in that chapter, one of the things that I do is that I look at the pleadings in these cases in Illinois and in Maryland and Memphis, and I see really what the legacy of racism and gender bias in lending practices has resulted in. That in 2005, 2006, you had loan officers, according to the complaints, you had loan officers saying that they would go out granny hunting on days looking for women, older women, to sell bad loans to, basically, or to take advantage of financially. You had lending officers referring to certain loans as ghetto loans, and saying that certain people who lived in certain neighborhoods, typically communities of color, didn't deserve any better. And so what it says to me is that the overt signs of racism may not exist for most of us to see, but look behind the curtain just a little bit and you find that they exist there and that they are really and in this case, I believe, had the capacity to bring down a whole financial system. Thank you. Thank you.
Professor Hill, first, I applaud you for being courageous today and in the past, and for standing up, because it's so difficult to do that some days. Mm-hmm. But my question is, and I have a concern, in this world that we're in, there are so many students that are saddled with loans of over $200,000. If there was some way that someone came up with some idea to free them of these shackles, there'd be such an infusion of wealth and spending. I'm sure you've thought about it. And thank you again.
Well, the cost of education has, as you say, it's skyrocketed. And a lot of times students are, they are saddled with debt. There are a few programs, there are a few government programs that allow students to get out from under those debts or from which they can get grants. But, those have really been diminishing over the last few decades, and it is a tragedy. I went to school in an era where we still had Pell Grants, and so because I qualified financially, my parents couldn't afford to send me to school, I could get a grant. Those are gone, and that has to really be a part of our reinvestment in education. Again, you know, we've got to have a conversation, though, that includes those kinds of realities of people's lives. That's not this book, but maybe it's the next one. We can get there.
I am one of the grandchildren of the Great Migration, so let's talk about home. Because I do have this amazing inheritance, I always closely identify with Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun. And so while we inherited this instinct to battle racial issues, we also inherited a heap of gender junk. So how do you propose we go to battle at home with this idea that whatever works for straight, able-bodied black men works for all of us? Because I'm tired of being fodder for other people's movements. I'm tired of my point of view not being heard as a black woman. How do you propose we continue to combat that?
You know, part of what we have got to think about is who is our representation? Who represents us in the nation that is making these policies? I mean, let's just take one example. We have lived forever with persistent wage gaps for women. It was, I guess, before the recession, 80 cents on the dollar, or close to 80 cents on the dollar women made versus the dollar that men made. Now the gap is narrowed, I understand, only because men are making less, not because women are making more. But I don't believe there's ever been an individual who in office, the Department of Labor, who has actually sat down and said, every day I'm going to get up and I'm going to think about this problem of the persistent wage gap between women and men. And I'm going to think about it and I'm going to work on it until something is done. And I'm going to try different policies, and I'm going to, you know, promote legislation that will help to do that. We haven't had it. So part of that is representation and who represents us and whether or not they think these concerns are a priority. We can change that. It's not going to happen overnight. I mean, and some of you are thinking, oh, well, that's impossible. The politics are such today. But, you know, how many of you would have predicted that Barack Obama could be president? So I think the question that you're raising, I do touch on in Reimagining Equality when I talk about how we do not value work coming out of the home. And typically that is the kind of work that women do, or that is done by women, not all women, but it's done by women, like childcare, like school teaching. Even something like I raise it in the chapter where I talk about Aunt Jeanette Booker, who is a hairdresser. We have got to understand and begin to see how we undervalue women. So that's a psychological change that we have to address. But there are policy changes that need to be made as well. And we have to put the right people in place to address those policy changes so that we can change some of the structures in our workplace. There are some legislation, some equal pay, legislation that is being proposed now that would help us begin to do that. And I won't embarrass you by asking you to raise your hand if you have called your congressperson to say, pass the Equal Pay Act. But if you haven't, please do. That will be a great start.
Hi, Professor Hill. It's a great honor to be here and be able to hear what you have to say and
thank you.
To learn about your new book. And I'm sorry, but I have to go back to history. I just think it's so interesting that you're here speaking to us today when Clarence Thomas is embroiled in a big controversy with the money that his wife has received from the corporation and the conflict of interest. And I wondered what you thought about that. And I wondered what you thought about when she... I also was so curious, what was your reaction when she came out and demanded that you apologize?
Well,
I can't help asking it.
I will just tell you, the results speak for itself. I didn't apologize. But I'm going to add... I will go about your question in a roundabout way. You said you were going to go to history, and I'll go a little bit to history, too. When I testified in 1991, it was really because I cared about the integrity of the court. That was what mattered to me, the integrity of the individuals who are appointed to lifetime positions on the court. That is what mattered then, that is what matters now, and that hasn't changed. And I will leave the rest for you to figure out
my answer. You think he'll be tossed out?
I don't know. I can't speculate about that. But again, it really, all of these questions, any of the questions that go to the integrity of the justices on the court are concerns that we all should have.
Absolutely.
Right. I was really struck by the separation of the American dream from, as you recently said here, this idea of purchasing a home and moving up and moving up, to this notion of home and belonging and sort of an investment in what I partially translated into a public space, meaning that our personal spaces and our families are also part of communities and part of the nation. And I wondered what you thought of the Occupy Wall Street idea and the idea of sort of wanting to have kitchens and community spaces on Wall Street. It wasn't just a protest. It's like a neighborhood
being set up. How things are done, how things look. You know what? The part of it that really resonates with me is that the fact that just a handful of people are really taking a stand, and they're raising their voices, and they're inspiring all of us to think differently. Part of what I'm not hearing so much about is the media getting engaged with it. And that is another thing that has to happen. I think there are some recipes for their success. It starts with their public, their engagement, their private engagement, private risk-taking. But again, there has to be some momentum that is built up. And the media can help to do that. That's really what I'm hoping will happen when we talk about home. I just can't see that we are going to be satisfied with going back to where we were, which is the situation in the early 2000s, the first of the new century, where we were just putting so much at risk in terms of the housing market. We have come to a point of crisis, and for me, it's a wake-up call. And if it requires us to go and camp out in front of Wells Fargo Bank, or to camp out in front of some other financial institution, so be it. But I don't think that it does. I think my idea is that we come together, all of us who have an interest in resolving this crisis, and that's everybody in this room, we come together and really start grappling with the issues of how we're going to move forward. And I'm hoping that when you read the book, that one, you'll think differently about the importance of home, and that two, whether you buy the whole idea of a home summit, that you do something different in the way that you act. I had a woman who said, I read the book, and what I did was I went and I volunteered in shelters to help people who were homeless. That may be what you do. But what I would say to you is use your voice, use your talents, use your skills to do something, because a future generation really is depending on you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to a program of Cambridge Forum recorded in October 2011, co-sponsored by the First Parish in Cambridge, the Lowell Institute, and the Friends of the Cambridge Forum.